Great, I appreciate that. And welcome you all to our first interim committee meeting on the Ag. And with that, I'll have Anita call the roll, please.
Thank you. Representative Schmidt.
Here.
Ammerman.
Here.
Bo.
Here.
Damshin. Hunsker. Dennis Johnson. Kiefer.
Here.
Larson.
Here.
Rust.
Here.
Trotier.
Here.
And Wall.
Here.
Senators Lulick. Bowman.
Here.
Dotsenrod. Herbley.
Here.
And Miller. Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum present.
Thank you, ma'am. Next agenda item is comments by the chairman. And one of the things I'd like to put out to the committee has to do with the Bank of North Dakota and beginning a farmer loan program. And if I may. And the reason that I bring this to your attention is that I had a constituent whose son just graduated from NDSU and wanted to come back to North Dakota and or come back to the farm and start farming and ranching with his family. And they had gone to the Bank of North Dakota to get a beginning farmer loan to see if they couldn't help their son get started. And in that process, the loan amount at the time was about $400,000, in which case they get 75%. And if you all have been around ag auction, land auctions, and price of land, you don't get much for $400,000 at 75% of that. Now, on the 1st of August, that amount went from $400,000 to $500,000. And so the concern was, is that enough funding for an individual to get started in agriculture, even if with the family with them? So I did a little bit of calling around, asking some questions, and I ended up talking with the Bank of North Dakota, and my apologies, I forget what the individual's name was. And he told me that the Bank of North Dakota had inventoried 63 banks. And their feelings was that the $500,000 was an appropriate amount at this time. And they felt that because the commodity prices were at a bubble and the land values were at a bubble, and they felt that those 63 banks felt that if there was an increase in value for land loans and the commodity prices dropped, that we would be putting a young agriculture producer in financial dire straits. And so the Bank of North Dakota felt it should have been up towards $750,000, but because of what the 63 bankers had suggested, they stayed with $500,000. So I wanted to bring that to the committee's attention that the beginning loan program is at $500,000, and I don't know that there's anything that the committee wishes to do with that or talk about that, but I wanted it to bring to your attention because the land prices, like I'll use out in Mott, for example, it used to go for $1,200 to $1,300 or now over $2,000. And I don't know how much land you can buy at a 75% of $500,000 for a beginning farmer. So just wanted to bring that to your attention. If the committee wishes to do something further with that, I'd certainly entertain that. But I think it's worthy of looking at. And I did ask him, if does that dollar figure that the bank sets, is that through legislation or is that, can they do that on their own with? And I was told that they can set that on their own. So with that, I just thought I'd bring it to your attention and we can decide whether you want to go with it or make any changes or modifications. Representative Larson.
Just a question about that then. With young farmers, will this allow them to get into the farming business? Or is this something that is going to prohibit them from being able to afford to even get into it?
I would look for some other input into answering that question, but it's a start, but you're not going to buy a whole lot of land for $500,000 at this point in time, I don't believe. I'd certainly be entertaining any other discussion that committee members may have with respect. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the observation I would make on it is, at current time right now, the interest rate spread from what you could get at local banks or from Farm Credit Services, I would guess that this program probably is just about worthless at this time, because I don't know that you're going to save a lot of money on the percentage. That was the huge impetus of it back when it was started, was to give an interest buy down to the young farmer so that he could compete. But right now with the interest rates, I don't know that this program, you know, that would be part of it we need to talk about or look at before we go and start expanding the program to more dollars, because I don't know if that is going to solve the issue.
Thank you. Would the committee wish to hear more about it in our next committee meeting? Probably get some presentation from the Bank of North Dakota, some others to discuss it. Would that be acceptable? Okay. Senator Bowman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that if we do this, we get some kind of background on how successful, when we first started this, the beginning farmers were, and the success today because of the risk that we're taking. When you invest, your $500,000 doesn't really buy you a big new combine anymore. So the risk that you take for that reward, is the bank's going to be willing to invest a whole lot more, knowing that they're putting these young kids at risk to lose everything? I don't know the answer to that, but I'd like to hear from some banks and talk about that, because it's a totally different environment than it was when I farmed after my dad died.
Agreed. Thank you. Okay, with that then, I'll work with Anita, and we'll put that on our next meeting agenda to talk about that, and we'll try to get a variety of groups, bankers, etc., to discuss that with us, and then figure out where we go as a committee from there. That'd be acceptable. Okay, thank you. Okay, the next agenda item, 10:05, presentation by Legislative Council staff of background memorandum. Anita.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have one other small piece of business to take care of, and that is to remind you that you have the supplementary rules of operation and procedure in your packet. Most of you are familiar with them, and given the past discussion in the last few minutes, I also need to point out to you that this committee cannot substantially expand its study without permission of the Legislative Council. So what Chairman Schmidt is suggesting we do is get some more information, and then you as a committee can determine whether that's something that you want to pursue. The other thing you need to be aware of is that any communications expressing policy have to get the permission of the Chairman of Legislative Council, and please do not form subcommittees. We need to keep everything in the open and on the record, and if we have subcommittees, then I end up working for that many more committees, and that's not a good thing. So. Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are 16 members on this committee, and 9 of you have never been involved in an ag interim rewrite effort. 3 are serving for the second time, 2 of you are serving for the third time, and Senator Bowman and Representative Johnson have drawn the short straw 4 times in a row. And the reason that's important is because rewrites are a little bit different from your normal interim studies, and we'll get into that in a minute. The current ag rewrite had its roots in the 2007 legislative session. Senator Flackel, together with Representative Johnson, in their respective roles as standing committee chairman, were experiencing some frustration with the ag laws. They seemed to be spread all over the century code, and they seem to, as a group, be somewhat irrelevant, duplicative, inconsistent, unclear, and illogically arranged. So those two gentlemen sponsored a bill calling for a mandatory rewrite. Now, I think people knew it was going to be a fairly large project and a fairly time-intensive project, and I don't think that any one of us fully understood the scope of this effort. Let me give you an example of the types of things we have come across. One of our statutes used to state, quote, "Scattering and dumping on land or in water of any material containing noxious weed seeds or propagating parts is prohibited unless such material has been processed or treated or buried sufficiently deep to destroy seeds and other propagating parts." Now, today the statute says a person may not willfully dispose of any material that contains noxious weed seeds or propagating parts in a manner that allows for the dissemination of noxious weeds. Now, whether or not you elect to bury the material first and then dig it up and scatter or dump it, that's entirely up to you. Senator Bowman remembers that discussion. So how did we get to the point of needing a rewrite? Well, each session you handle between 19 and 1400 bills, and then you add the amendments on top of that. Now, each of those was crafted by someone. It may have been an attorney in our office or an attorney with the Attorney General's office. It may have been a legislator or a lobbyist, agency personnel, a constituent, or an intern. Now, most attorneys are not trained in legislative drafting, and the others in that list certainly are not. And what I keep reminding people is that while words are precise, people's ability to use words precisely varies tremendously. And if you have ever written a love letter or a letter to the editor or a column in your local newspaper, think about how challenging it is to take the thoughts that are in your mind, commit them to permanence in a way that ensures another person is going to interpret them the way you intend. Now, most people operate on the rule of, it's close enough. We know what we mean. We know how this is supposed to work. But 2 years or 10 years or 40 years down the line, someone who was not a party to the original negotiations may find themselves in the position of having to determine what was meant and how it's supposed to work. Now, as legislators, I found you folks to be a fairly polite group, and often when you're looking at the printed word, you don't want to be perceived as being insulting by saying that someone's effort is less than meritorious. And being human, there's also a reluctance to stand up and say, this makes no sense to me, especially if you think that everyone around you is comprehending it just fine. But the reality is that legislation needs to be understood, and it needs to be understood the same way by those who are enacting it, those who are implementing it, and those who are subject to it. Clarity in the written word is an achievable goal. It just takes time and it takes effort. But if that goal is not achieved, over time you add additional words and phrases, and pretty soon you reach a point of incomprehensibility. Now, another scenario with respect to why we need rewrites has to do with shelf life. Now, you know, leisure suits were once all the rage, but that doesn't mean that you should continue to retain them as a wardrobe staple. Same thing with statutes. At one time, it may have been appropriate for the Agriculture Commissioner to retain all records used by or in connection with the Office of the Commissioner of Immigration. But today, there are arguably better repositories. Similar to shelf life is the concept of necessity or relevance. If you never did or no longer use a word or a phrase anywhere in the chapter, you don't need to define it. Also, if you have a word such as person, that's already defined in Title I of the Century Code. It's applicable to the entire code. You don't need to repeat it in each specific chapter. And as we get into the rewrite, we'll talk about these in a few other situations. Now, whereas with your other interim committees, individuals, either on their own behalf or on behalf of the groups that they represent, will provide you with background information, and they will articulate their concerns or their wishes. Toward the end of the study period, you may ask for bill drafts to reflect that which you've heard. With the rewrite, it's just the opposite. We will begin with the bill drafts. Now, for round one, I've taken existing statutory sections and started the cleanup process using the standard overstrikes and underscores. And I've also inserted notes after the sections, and sometimes even after individual sentences, to indicate that there are issues you might want to address. And these can include everything from the, do we really need this, to, I don't understand what we're trying to do here, but if we talk about it some more, maybe I can understand and then draft something that, that you can consider the next time. And there will be multiple times for all of these drafts. When we talk about the sections and you give me direction, I will put your directives into a revised draft. Now, the second draft you get is going to look like brand new legislation. And the reason that we do this is so that we have maximum flexibility to move around the various parts and to put them in a logical order. Once a section meets with your approval, we will not revisit it. We'll concentrate in successive drafts only on those issues that are still problematic. Now, unless there is a section that is hotly contested, we generally work on a consensus model. We won't be taking voice votes or roll call votes until the draft is completed and you have to determine whether or not you want to recommend it to legislative management. In accordance with Legislative Council policy, when we have drafts that are ready to be shared with the interested parties, we will also send copies to you. And the hope is that that gives everybody enough time to review the material and be prepared to provide some meaningful feedback at the meetings. Now, we're starting off with the ginseng chapter and the professional soil classifiers today. Obviously, there are other chapters that will be added on. Deciding how many and which ones will be up to Chairman Schmidt. And he very graciously is keeping tabs on my time commitments with respect to another little portfolio that I dabble in from time to time. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's the bird's eye view of what we're going to do. If you have any questions about the process, I would be very happy to try and answer them for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Anita. Any other comments or questions with respect with what Anita presented? If not, we're moving ahead of schedule, I believe.
We'll drag this out, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, we'll drag it out. Okay. All right. With that, let's move on to the next. Representative Johnson.
I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, would be is, where are we in this process? Rewriting, are we halfway into it or a third of the way into it, or how many more sessions are we going to go with this, Anita?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, we're all having such a good time here. This could take me through to retirement. You can see from the background memorandum, we have made some progress. We have some that are obviously still to go. And it's very difficult to answer that question because a lot depends on what else is on the plate. Every time somebody asks me a simple little question and I have to work for two weeks to do a memo, that's 2 weeks that comes out of the rewrite process. And then some of the chapters are going to be very simple and some, as you well know, much more complicated. But I would anticipate at least another two interims.
I guess that's my thoughts. Some of these that we've worked with in the past have taken some time with the seed and the different ones we've worked with, you know, but some of these are relatively short, I would think, but you know, how much you're going to put on the schedule as far as how fast we're going to move forward with this or...
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I've got to get back into the mode of speaking to you folks again. we thought we'd start off with a very simple one, the ginseng bills. You can see it's fairly short. The discussions may take that a little bit in a broader capacity, so it just depends.
Thank you for handing that out, and we'll certainly turn it over to the Department of Ag. If you please introduce yourselves and begin the discussion. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Charles Alhard, Plant Protection Specialist with the North Dakota Department of Agriculture. And this is Terry Larson, Division Director of Plant Industries Division with Department of Agriculture. I put together for you today a quick background on ginseng and a few facts that I was able to find. American ginseng is a perennial plant that grows native in forested areas of eastern United States. It is highly sought after in East Asia, specifically China and Korea, for its medicinal properties, including lowering blood pressure and cholesterol, reduces stress, and enhanced strength. Due to over-harvesting in the 1970s, ginseng is now protected under the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species, or CITES. CITES is enforced by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which allows each state to regulate harvest and trade of ginseng, both wild and cultivated. Cultivated ginseng is included with wild because of its similarities. 25 states are currently authorized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to administer the programs, and North Dakota is among six of those who only regulate cultivated ginseng because they don't have wild populations. Each year we are required to submit a harvest report to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The current process, according to our law, requires growers and dealers to be registered. We currently have two registered growers, one of which is actively growing, and to my knowledge, North Dakota has never had a dealer registered. A few facts about ginseng. It requires nearly 90% shade to grow in climates that receive about 40 inches of precipitation annually, a highly organic soil, usually in the forest floor, with a low pH around 5.5. Seeds take an average of 18 months to germinate. And when cultivated, they're usually grown for 3 to 5 years before harvest. In the wild, usually 8 to 10. The current average selling price for ginseng roots is approximately $500 to $600. It varied from what I found. A 2 ounce dried root sample is worth about $75. I found fresh roots selling on eBay for about $100 for a 6 ounce root. The annual value of ginseng in the United States is approximately $27 million, and it's marketed in many products, including toothpaste, soft drinks, tea, candy, chewing gum, and then powdered extract or whole root forms. I've been in contact with Jim Erickson, our current grower. Very nice guy. He shared a lot of information with us, and he's been registered with the department since 2000. But he has never reported a harvest due to difficulty to establish in his area. Seeds germinated easily, but only had about 10% after the first year and 1% of plants surviving by the third year. He's planted thousands of seeds and currently has about 100 plants. The deer, especially, will come through and eat off the leaves and the berries, and when planted too close together, they succumb to disease fairly easily. But this year he was finally able to collect seed, which he will be planting this fall for next spring, and he expects a small harvest next season. In the bottom are a couple pictures, and the picture on the left is a mature plant. It has about, you can tell the age by the number of leaves it has. This picture has 4 leaves, which means the plant is about 10 years old. And then the picture on the right is just some fresh roots. Thank you.
A couple of questions for you, if I may. Is ginseng indigenous to North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, there's no native populations in North Dakota.
Yeah. If it is an endangered species, does it not fall under other state regulations and legislation? Or is this the only legislation that addresses ginseng?
To my knowledge, this is the only thing.
Are there any questions from the committee? Hearing none. I'd appreciate it. Terry, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, no, I do not. Charles covered everything that there is to know about ginseng. Like he mentioned, we just have the one grower, never have come in with a harvest, and this program remains in effect for in case someone were to ever have a harvest and would like to sell or ship out of state. So that's why the program is still here. We would just like to see the law cleaned up a little bit so it's easier to understand.
Do you foresee any opportunity based on the requirement to raise it that would change?
No, I don't think so. I think a lot of Anita's comments that she put in and how to clean it up are really good. It does make it simpler to understand and hopefully just more streamlined. If we're required to have this program under federal law, we would like it to be simpler to understand.
Okay. Representative Trottier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charles, do you think this could it be grown in a pot?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Mr. Erickson tried to plant some in a pot, and to overwinter it, he had to bury it in the ground, otherwise the soil would freeze out and kill the plant. So there's that possibility, I suppose.
I may continue. It has to freeze then like a bulb or?
To, yes, it would have to freeze to go dormant and
right.
Okay. Yep, correct.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman and Charles, is NDSU doing any research on ginseng at all? And then, or is there any other plant in North Dakota that is similar to ginseng? And do we have anything to worry about other than just ginseng in this particular draft?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, as far as I know, NDSU is not doing any research currently on ginseng, and it is the only plant that should be addressed in this draft.
Continue. Mr. Chairman and Charles, that's my question was then basically, should this only identify for the purpose of this draft just that specific ginseng, or if there should be other plants included into this draft so we could make it more usable throughout, you know, for other legislative purposes, for let's say if some other type of plant came up next year that is deemed endangered, that could be just incorporated into this.
To my knowledge, not that I can think of.
Well, Charles, having read this a couple of times trying to understand it, and I'm still not sure that I do, I find it right now in my mind difficult that we've got such a 6 pages of legislation for something that occurs so infrequently. It's not indigenous to the state of North Dakota. We have other endangered plants in the state of North Dakota that come under other purviews. And I guess I don't understand why this should be separated out into its own legislation when we have other plants that are the same way. And so I have a difficulty with this type of legislation under this scenario. I mean, we obviously, Mr. Erickson has never reported a harvest, and it's been in 13 going on 14 years. So I'm kind of wondering if there isn't some way that we can't address the endangered species thing, even though it's not indigenous and though we don't have many, how we can address the endangered species without going any further and making it more cumbersome than it is. And with that, we've got 10:30 and I wish to stay on schedule, so let's take a 15-minute break, then we'd please come back. Thank you. Okay, with that, I believe Representative Bowe, you have a comment to make?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion. I move that we eliminate the chapter regarding, referring to ginseng and move it to the Ag Department so that they can address it in rules to take care of the industry.
Second, and second by Senator Bowman. Any discussion? Hearing none. Representative Rust.
Mr. Chairman, is that appropriate? I mean, is there anything we need to check with regard to whether or not that's allowable? Does it have to be legislation, do you know, or can it be rules?
Representative, to the best of my knowledge, it doesn't identify whether it has to be legislation or rule. The other thing is that if we proceed in this manner and we find out differently as we go along, we still can take it up at another one of our interim committee meetings. Any further discussion? Senator Luick?
Mr. Chairman and committee, I believe also, just as a comment, I believe that this being in Centric Code isn't necessarily necessary, and it's overwritten by USDA federal rules anyway. So to extend this that far is silly. So
thank you, sir. Any other comments? Hearing none, we'll have Anita take the roll.
Representative Schmidt.
Yes.
Representative Ammerman.
Yes.
Representative Bowe.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Representative Kiefert.
Yes.
Representative Larson.
Yes.
Representative Rust.
Aye.
Representative Trottier.
Yes.
Representative Wall.
Yes.
Senator Luick.
Yes.
Senator Bowman.
Yes.
And Senator Eberle.
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes, and we'll assign Anita to work with that with the Commissioner's Department and move in that direction. And again, please note, if that's not legal to do it that way, we will take it up again. Okay, thank you. At this time, I'd like to add a little agenda item, thanks to Julie Ellingson. She's got some information to present to us with respect to what happened in South Dakota with the storm, and I think that would be worthy of listening. So with that, Ms. Ellingson.
Chairman Schmidt and interim committee members, thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief report. We've received a lot of calls and questions about the situation related to livestock disaster over the last couple of weeks. As you know, 1 month ago, Winter Storm Atlas hit southwestern North Dakota as well as our neighboring South Dakota pretty significantly. Again, while the numbers are still preliminary, it looks to be the tens of thousands of livestock that were lost in that storm, which began with a lot of rain as well as followed up by some heavy wet snow and some wind, which impacted our area, but particularly South Dakota. The outpouring of support has been outstanding. As you know, the Farm Bill is still in transition. Conference committees are working on that right now. The livestock disaster assistance programs are included in both the House and the Senate versions of that legislation that's being reconciled right now. And the livestock indemnity program is one of those disaster assistance programs, which will provide some base level support for producers, and we're hopeful and very optimistic that those will be renewed. What that will pay is somewhere between 65% and 75% of the market value of the animals that were lost. And again, what we've been telling producers, and you can pass along to your constituents, that's very important that they keep very thorough records to verify not only their losses, but their inventory and their inventories, and to have also third parties verify those losses, take photos and such, so when the programs are renewed, they're ready to apply and won't get caught in some kind of loophole in that. Also, with your permission, we'll pass out a press release that our association is going to issue today. There's a disaster relief effort in South Dakota called the Ranchers Relief Fund that are collecting some private donations to help support livestock producers in that area. Our association and foundation are also establishing a fund to help North Dakota ranchers who have been impacted. And so we'll be announcing that to the public today. And with your permission, I would pass those out. Before I do that, are there any questions from the committee that I can help with?
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Julie, when you said that it's going to cover 75% of the loss, tell me what that means. Does that mean of their initial investment or of what they were expecting to be able to make once the cattle were more grown?
Right. Chairman Schmidt and Representative Larson, assuming that the livestock indemnity program moves forward as it has in the past, what it does, it actually pays for catastrophic losses beyond a normal mortality rate. Again, that can be verifiable, related to weather-related issues. So in this case, there's an established and an average mortality for different classes of livestock that is established by Farm Service Agency with input from organizations and the agricultural industry. And again, it's up to the 65% to 75% of the market value of those animals. And basically, they establish those numbers by the market value over the course of the year. So there'll be a different dollar value for 2012 versus 2013. And that's a national average, is how they come up with those numbers.
Senator Bowman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Julie, do you have any information on the program that where they're farmer or ranchers are consigning replacement heifers to give to those ranchers with that loss? Because I know my daughter in Miles City called me and told me out there she's working with a group of ladies, and I think they had like 200 and some heifers already consigned. So is that happening in North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bowman, yes, there's a variety of relief efforts that have sprung up across the region. The outpouring of support has been outstanding. I don't have any specific information about that, but I think the one you're referencing, there's some folks that are actually donating animals, and somebody's compiling those to gift to those who were devastated. My information that I have doesn't indicate that, but if you would like some additional about that specific program, I could get that to you.
Okay.
Representative Trottier, then Representative Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Julie, and maybe this can go to Senator Bowman also. Should there be, and I've had some concern from background feeders, people that purchase the calves from southwest North Dakota and west South Dakota, should there be any concern of health of those calves that were on the cows at that time?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Trottier, we do see some subsequent loss, again, on things that have stemmed from, again, started on the October 4th and 5th event, and that certainly was a stressor to cattle, to all classes of cattle. Again, hopefully time and some normalization of the weather pattern will help that, but certainly there are impacts that come long after the storm has surpassed.
Representative Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Julie, I'm trying to figure out in my mind how this all works, so I'm going to ask maybe a question that might be a little late, indicate my ignorance, which isn't always that hard for me to do. But would these farmers also have insurance on those animals that would whereby they'd be compensated for the animal somewhat through that insurance policy? And then how does this disaster relief fit in if that's the case?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Russ, that's not a dumb question at all. There really isn't any commercially available insurance to cover the type of loss that was incurred in the storm Atlantis. Again, most of those deaths related to inhaling all that the wet, the animals died of hypothermia and such, and there's some livestock policies that are available, but those are more common for drowning or lightning, things of that nature, but there really is not commercially available livestock insurance that deal with the kind of weather-related disaster that this provides. And that's one of the, I guess, the merits of the livestock indemnity program. Again, not to pay for losses that are beyond the normal mortality that are specifically attributable to a weather-related event.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Chairman Schmidt. Julie, I'm aware of the somewhat of the numbers of livestock lost in South Dakota. I really haven't heard any numbers in North Dakota. Do you have any feel for numbers of livestock lost to the storm in North Dakota?
Chairman Schmidt and Representative Wall, I wish I had a better answer for that question. Again, with no livestock indemnity program, there really isn't an incentive now for people to report their losses. FSA, here in the state, did some preliminary calculations of the hardest-hit counties. There was kind of a seven-county area that was really the focus of the storm. Again, preliminarily, there was about 1,000 head that were accounted for that died immediately. Again, I think those numbers are much larger than that because of the subsequent loss and because there isn't, again, the priority one has been to take care of the animals, again, whether dealing with carcass removal and burial, and also to deal with the animals that have been stressed and subsequently are lost. And again, really no mechanism or incentive now to do that reporting. I think those numbers will mount considerably. Again, we had a significant impact here in North Dakota. Much harder hit, though, across the border in South Dakota, even though the stories that we're hearing are single and double-digit losses with most of the herds in North Dakota that were impacted. Unfortunately, across the border, those numbers are triple digits in many cases.
Julie, a question that I have, and I'm not sure I understand what Senator Bowman was referring to, but if an individual gets a number of donated animals, does that impact the federal assistance that producer may get?
Representative Schmidt, I don't believe that's the case. This is a private project, and so producers are putting together animals, some of the best females from their herd, and again, someone's coordinating the donation of those animals to people who are in need. The project that we're working on through the Stockmen's Association and our foundation actually is going to be accepting donations of cash, and we will pass that along. Again, in North Dakota, we're going to do an application kind of program where producers in need can apply for those funds, and then those will be allocated based on need and the dollars we have available. Similarly, a program in South Dakota organized by our counterparts across the border are utilizing cash, but a variety of different efforts that have popped up, and again, heartwarming to see the support for the people who have been impacted.
Any other comments or questions from the committee for Julie? If not, please provide us with a copy of your press release.
Thank you for your time this morning.
With that, our next agenda item is, beg your pardon, comments by others that relating to, yeah, we can even talk about the ginseng comments too, right? Any other further comments by anyone at this time? The agenda item at 1 o'clock will have to stand at 1 o'clock because the professional soil classifiers, that is when they will be here. So you're going to have an extended lunch period from 11 to 1 because I do not want to start that agenda item without those individuals. So that's where we'll be headed. So we will adjourn if there's no further comments. Senator Bowman.
Yeah, I'd like to comment just a little bit about that storm. I came through Lemon, South Dakota at about 11 o'clock that night, and there wasn't a light on for 50 miles nowhere. You couldn't see a light in the country. You couldn't see a light in the town of Lemon. There was probably, I don't know, maybe close to 2 feet of snow, but the drifts were higher than the car. The snow plow had gone through and plowed the road so you could continue. But there were semi-trucks parked right in the middle of the highway that, and they probably gelled up is what I'm assuming they happened. There was five of them right downtown Lemon. It was terrible. But to the people that work for Rural Electrics, you got to take your hat off to them. They were out there at 11 o'clock at night, had the lights up on the poles, and were trying to get electricity back to those people. Pretty touching.
Thank you. Any other comments? If not, we'll adjourn till 1 o'clock. Thank you.
background memorandum entitled Registration of Professional Soil Classifiers with Anita, please.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Section 2 of 2013 House Bill 1154 directed a study of North Dakota Century Code provisions that relate to professional soil classifiers. That includes their qualifications and examinations and the powers and duties of the State Board of Registration for Professional Soil Classifiers. This was all, again, for the purpose of recommending changes to laws that are irrelevant, inconsistent, illogically arranged, or unclear in their intent and direction. Now, the background memorandum addresses our human need to classify and categorize things. And although I am not a student of human nature, apparently we do this so that we can describe in uniform terms and understand what is meant by others using those terms. Now, as an example, a ponderosa pine is a ponderosa pine. An Abert squirrel is an Abert squirrel wherever you find them. They don't begin to morph into something different as they reach the outer edges of their habitat. But when it comes to soils, apparently their nature and properties can vary widely from one location to the next, and even within limited geographic areas. Now, these particular challenges prompted a relatively new Soil Classifiers Association to pursue legislation in 1973 that would recognize soil classification as a profession and establish thresholds for entry into the profession. Now, in the ensuing 40 years, there have been relatively few changes to the original legislation, and that's where we're going to begin with our interim efforts. The statutorily created State Board of Registration for Professional Soil Classifiers consists of three professional soil classifiers and two at-large members, all of whom are appointed by the governor. Now, the board is the profession's regulatory entity. It registers soil classifiers, and it certifies soil classifiers in training. Now, entry into the profession is dependent on good character and reputation, as evidenced by multiple references, the passage of an examination, and a demonstration of academic background and appropriate experience. Now, as most professional boards, this one also has the ability to reprimand individuals and to suspend or to revoke their registration or their certification, as well as to refuse renewal. Now, one of the challenges before this interim committee is going to be identifying what is envisioned within the profession of soil classification, who is required to abide by the provisions of the chapter. And it's important because failing to abide by the chapter carries a Class B misdemeanor, which is 30 days imprisonment, a $1,500 fine, or both. Now, you can see the current definitions in both the background memorandum and in the bill draft, and you'll also note that in the bill draft, we have started to break down the definition so we can work our way through what it is entailed in that issue. Now, one final comment. As referenced earlier, the focus of the rewrite is to clean up and clarify the law. But if you go back to the legislative history for 2013 House Bill 1154, you'll see a recognition that this chapter seemed to need a closer look at its substance. And clearly that would have entailed more work than there was time available during the legislative session. So the bill draft provided for both a study of the chapter and, if appropriate, a rewrite of the provisions. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the background memorandum.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee for Anita? Senator Bowman?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, has there been any problems with this section of the law dealing with those that worked in this profession, or is this just for our purpose to try to streamline the law and update it to a better law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bowman, over the course of the study, you're going to hear from representatives in various agencies with respect to how they use soil classifiers and issues that they are encountering with the law as it currently sits.
Okay.
Committee, have any further questions? If not, thank you, Anita. Our next step will be just to jump right into the bill. And the plan is to go through section by section. And as we get to the end of the A section, I will ask for any further comments from the audience.
on each one of those sections. We are not going to be making any decisions whatsoever today. All we want to do is go through these sections, discuss them, hear from other constituents with regards to how they would use this section or how they view this section. So with that, let's start with the first, be page one, and I will turn it over to Anita to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, you can see beginning on line 7, we took out the definition of a board. It seems that it's just as easy to reference the board in the particular sections, and we've been doing that so it's consistent with what we've already done in Title 4.1. One of the things that you are being asked to look at is the name, and as the note says, with the exception of the State Board of Registration for Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors, the various professional boards don't mention registration within their official names. The Marriage and Family Therapy Licensure Board is the one that references licensure. So you may want to start with an initial discussion of whether or not the board's name is longer than it needs to be.
Okay, with that, I would look to the two gentlemen, and please identify yourselves and who you represent for the record, please. And in order to, if your microphone is on, if the blue light's on, if the blue light's off, you're off. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lawrence Edlund. I am on the Governor's Board for Professional Self-Classifiers. I'm from Mandan.
My name is Darrell Vanderbush. I'm also on the board, appointed by the governor also.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. With that, then, I would look for your comments with respect to that section.
I guess the only comment I have, I don't have an issue with taking the name professional off the board, but I think it's important that we maintain the name professional when it comes to the law, because as in any of the other professions, we are required to take examinations and have years of experience before we can't become registered.
Mr. Chairman, also on our people registered, we do have 3 doctorates, people who have gotten their doctorate degree, and I think about 5 people who have gotten their master's. So we do have a lot of people on there with a lot of education. That's being actively working.
Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen, would you bear with me and define just what a soil classifier does for everybody?
Yes. Originally, the soil scientists predominantly were hired by the Natural Resource Conservation Service, or the Soil Conservation Service, back when I started. And that was to map and classify soils. And as Anita kind of explained, you can classify soil just like you do a tree or a mammal. I mean, they all have different properties, different characteristics. And that's primarily the function of those characteristics is what we use to make the soil interpretations. And we're different from the geologists in that we look at what is referred to as suitable plant growth material, the upper 5 feet of the earth's surface that support plant life. And that's where we primarily make our interpretations from. If that answered your question, Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue. Okay, so a soil classifier basically goes out for assessment value of topsoil in plant growth soils that determines whether it's the taxable value, whether it is the sale value, and then what other industries actually use soil classifiers and for what purpose.
Okay. To begin with, when this law was put in place, the biggest user of soil classifiers was the coal industry. before any mine is stripped, another soil survey is done, not, we call them Order 1 soil surveys, which are more intense than what the soil survey is that's published by NRCS. And that was one of the major things. It has now gone in that we are doing a lot of septic field work for interpretation, and also with a lot of wetland work, identifying wetlands and mitigation sites and reviewing what's out there. Also with the landfills that are going in, doing a very detailed soil survey before the land is stripped so that they know they have suitable material to put back to cover that landfill. And the reason, you know, one of the reasons I think we need to be registered is that we have a lot of out-of-state companies in North Dakota right now, and they have people from all over the U.S. and are not familiar with the soils that we have here. And with the spills that are coming in and everything else, we really need more people from around this region to work so we know how to get those soils back to what they were.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that this is an irrelevant question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I live along the Missouri River, and with the flood 2 years ago, we had 4 feet of sand dumped on our property as the river scoured. So I'm guessing that our soil has changed and its quality now that it's sand. And then would there ever be a situation where, like a soil classifier would come and say that the Corps needs to get our ground back to the way it was?
One of the things that myself, I do work as a consultant. I do work with a lot of engineering firms, and that has not come up, but if somebody wished to, you know, we would look at the only thing we could do is see what's down below what you have deposited there and see what, you know, and make interpretations as to plant growth or yield of crops or something that would be different now because of the material. A lot of our work is we'll go on site and dig holes and things. We work with individual companies or individuals is how a lot of it's done.
Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman, are all soil classifiers a soil scientist also, or is there a definition between the two?
I'd say yes. Anyone that is registered, when I worked for the Soil Conservation Service and the NRCS, we weren't considered soil classifiers, we were considered soil scientists. So they're essentially one and the same. To add to what Darrell was saying, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lewick, in that a lot of my work that I've been doing since I started contract work has been with mine reclamation, whether it's for sanitary landfills or for the coal mines. And I think it's important that we remember when we're doing that we're really focusing on saving us a resource that's been there for a long time, and that we want to maintain that resource as best we can.
We've kind of veered off from where we were headed with this item, but I've got one question that I'd like to ask you, gentlemen. Does a soil scientist have to be a professional soil classifier to determine hydric soils for wetland delineations?
I feel so, in that you can take core classes that Chairman Schmidt, you can take soil classes or core classes that train you to become a delineator. But unless you're familiar with the soils, I've seen too many times people coming from Minnesota and South Dakota, or people from North Dakota that have been gone to this core training and come back and say, well, all of these soils are hydric because they're all black. Well, if they look at the exemptions in the hydric indicator book, it specifically sets in the notes that that's not the case. And I've seen instances where they'll come out and they'll say, well, this soil is hydric because it meets these particular hydric criteria, when in fact it isn't hydric, because if you dig deep enough, it doesn't meet the criteria. So I think it is important. I know there's a lot of people, companies doing wetland determinations, and I just hope they're doing it justice to both to the landowner and to the resource.
Any further questions of these gentlemen? Representative Trotter.
What does hydric mean?
Representative Trotter, Mr. Chairman. Hydric is one of the three indicators to identify a wetland. In order for a wetland to exist, you need three criteria. You need plants, you need hydrology, and you need a hydric soil. Hydric soils have to meet specific requirements. So they have to have certain colors, they have to have certain wetness, they have to have, and these are all identified in what they call the hydric or wetland guide.
Senator Bowman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, sir, as you're determining the different soils, there's got to be a really thin line, doesn't there, between this classification and that classification if the soils are intermixed. I mean, I can see where someone would say, well, this is this. Another guy comes out and says, well, no, it qualifies for this because, and that line would be, have to be awfully close, wouldn't it, as to what category it falls in?
Senator Bowman, Mr. Chairman. Yes, but soils are very specific, although, you know, like anything, there's a gray boundary between them. There's going to be a gray area between one soil and the next. Depending on the order of the survey that you do, typically order two soil surveys that we did for NRCS, they have what we call inclusions in them. So you have a delineation that we call one soil, but or two soils, but there's many soils included with those. So sometimes it becomes more of an art than a science, but the soils are very specific.
Any other questions? Then let us get back to the point of line number 7, if we may. And then I'd like to call upon others to come to the podium that have interest in this one particular item. But before I do that, is there any more comments from the committee on line 7? Representative Larson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering then, if we're looking at the possibility of just shortening the name, you both referenced why you would want to keep professional in there, but what if it were to be, if you were to drop just registration for, so it would be State Board of Professional Engineers and Land Surveyors. You'd still have the word professional in there, but it would be able to be shortened a bit. It was just a question.
Do you gentlemen care to respond?
I guess personally, for myself, I'm not speaking for the rest of the board, but I don't see an issue with taking that out of, like I say, if it's directing just the board, I don't have an issue with taking professional out. If it's changing the code that deals with the rest of the profession, yeah, I do. I'd like to see that in.
Okay, Anita.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've got a couple of things going on here. What I was referring to first was whether or not you would be comfortable with removing the reference to registration, not at this point professional. And so, if we had the Board of Physical Therapists or the Board of Auditors, we could have the Board of Professional Soil Classifiers. It's just, it makes it very difficult for some of us to say it often. So that was one issue. And then I think the discussion about the use of the word professional is coming up here in the next page or so, so we can get into that. but if we can focus on the registration for right now.
Could you clarify, please? Darrell?
I guess I don't have an issue with that, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Thomas, I if we drop that professional, that's that'd be fine. Registration.
Drop registration.
Mr. Chairman, just a brief history. North Dakota was one of the first states to get registration for cell classifier cell sinus. And a lot of states have patterned their individual laws after ours and stuff too. So it's we've been in the forefront of some of this.
Okay, thank you. I have a comment with respect to that. And my comment is that we're being told that North Dakota has probably the only state that has this type of law.
Now, Mr. Chairman, from what I understand, there's about 50% of the states that have registered professional cell classifiers, and predominantly from here to the east. you go straight south, South Dakota does not, Nebraska does. I can't speak for Kansas or Oklahoma. Texas does. In fact, Texas has requested reciprocity with North Dakota. But we have some issues with that. If anybody has any questions about that, I guess. That's
so there are other states that have this type of legislation.
Absolutely.
In code. Okay. Senator Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, do you know if North Dakota's registration requirements and or their code is more strict than other states?
Go ahead. Senator, we actually have two tests to become registered. One is a fundamental, one is a practical. The fundamental test that we have is actually a test that is put out by RPACS, which is basically and administered by the Society of Agronomy. And so we have basically gone to their test for the fundamental test, which is a written test. So that is nationally accepted. And then we have our own practical test, where we require an individual to do soil descriptions and interpretations to show that they actually know what soils and how soils react in North Dakota. Far as I know, Minnesota also has the fundamental and the practical. And I think Texas, I think, also does. I couldn't be sure. I'd have to look through these other states to see exactly. But they all have some kind of testing because they want to be sure that whoever works in their particular area is familiar with their soils.
Yes, Senator Lewick and Mr. Chairman, yeah, that was part of the deal with our not at this point getting registration, our reciprocity, I'm sorry, with Texas is that they would accept our fundamental test that was given prior to ours going nationally, but they still wanted us to take the Texas practical exam. And we said, in order for us to have reciprocity, we would want the same thing for them. If they came up and wanted to practice in North Dakota, that we would want them to show us through our exam that they can interpret our soils.
Is there any other further questions? Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how far apart would you do soil samples? Because I would assume that soil can change from one location to the next, but how far apart would you need to do this if there was going to be some work done on a piece of land?
Representative Larson, this would depending what use you're going to make of that land. If we're going to do a septic field, we would put down more holes than if we probably are going to do stripping to cover a landfill. Because a septic field, you would want to know within a small zone how much water that soil can actually absorb. So you'd design your drain field to what type of soils were there. If we're going to strip a 7-acre area, we wouldn't need to know as much about the soil. We wouldn't need to put as many holes in as close together. We'd put a lot of holes in, but not necessarily as close together. So it depends upon the use that's going to be made.
Yeah, just Representative Larson and Chairman Schmidt. In the old NRCS, SCS soil survey, the Order 2 surveys, we kind of figured about every 800 feet that we would examine the soil. But it was more of a landscape survey than it was specific to, you know, a distance. In Order 1 surveys that we're now doing for the coal mines and for reclamation, it can be anywhere from 100 feet to 200 feet. So it's significantly much more dense.
Any further question? Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, in the last 40 years, if we were going to graph out how many professional soil classifiers we have in North Dakota, would that graph be increasing or would it decrease? Where are we at for numbers for compared to where we were at in 1973?
I think Representative, I think the numbers have held fairly steady. We've gotten older members, which of course have gotten off. But this year we have had two new individuals that have become registered in the state. So we've always been a small number, mainly because the amount of work we did was not very large. But now with the boom that's going on, the amount of work has expanded greatly. So is for all the other professions. And we're going to keep pushing to try and get more people registered in the state to try and cover the need. That's one of the goals that the board has right now, that we need to get more people registered.
Do you have a number of how many we have in the state right now?
We have about 16 people who are actually practicing. I don't remember what the number was that aren't. We have two categories. One is if you're registered but not practicing, it's one amount for dues, and if you're actually practicing, it's another amount. So we do separate who's actually doing work in the state and who's basically not, but continuing their registration.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative and Chairman Schmidt, that was one of the reasons that we opened up, that we wanted to make modifications to the bill, to the Century Code, is that we were finding that individuals from another state that wanted to get registered here were not able to find the number of professional soil classifiers required by the law to be a reference. So we lowered that reference number from 3 to 1, thinking that if they knew one professional soil classifier would be sufficient if they were still able to take the practical exam and interpret the soils in North Dakota correctly. We felt that was the most critical part. So when we did that, we allowed one from Minnesota and one from Wyoming to become registered, and hoping for more. We have two individuals that are soil classifiers in training at the time.
For the record, gentlemen, I would appreciate if you could get back to Anita with the exact numbers that you have. And so we would have that in the record so that the committee members would know exactly what you have.
Mr. Chairman, just to let you know, we do have a website with this information, but we will get that information for you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The website, what's the URL for it?
Representative Rust, Mr. Chairman, I just Google professional soil classifiers and you'll get it.
But you have to use from North Dakota, because otherwise you'll get other states.
Representative Rust, if you go on to the
state site
for the North Dakota Boards and Commissions, you'll find it, Anita tells me. Any further questions? If not, I would invite those from the audience that would like to make comment to this section to come forth and do so. Okay, seeing none, we'll move right into the second item. item, which is line 9 through 10, with a note afterwards. And Anita, I'll turn it over to you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is the definition of kind of soil, and I have a public disclaimer here. I'm a music major, all right? That was my first life. So some of this terminology just makes me scratch my head. So I'm looking at the definition of the kind of soil. It's, that phrase is used twice in subsections 3 and 7, as noted. And I guess the question is it necessary to define kind of soil, given the fact that we're also defining soil? Is that such a tremendous distinction that we need to have it in the century code, or is it that broadly misunderstood?
Ms. Thomas, Chairman Schmidt, I think we should have it defined somehow. I'm not sure that what it says there as far as the landscape morphology is what's needed, but defining soil, I think, yeah, is important in the law.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, defining soil and defining kind of soil, do we need them both, or can we work on a definition that's a little more inclusive, perhaps?
Yes, Ms. Thomas, Chairman Schmidt, I think we could work on that. I don't think we need both. As long as we have an understanding of what soil is, I think that's the primary thing. And again, Chairman Schmidt, I think this is an opportunity to clean up some of the things that are kind of vague in the century code. And that's when we sat down with legislative council last November and started looking at this, that was one of the issues that Ms. Thomas brought up was, you know, some of this is not very understandable. We need to bring it to a modern language that's more understandable. And that was our goal. After lowering the number of references required to make it a little more accessible for others to become registered.
Any questions with regards to this from the committee? If not, I will again ask from the audience, if there anybody from the audience wishes to address this issue, please come forward. Okay, if not, let's move on. And I believe, Anita, the next note covers lines 11 through line 12 on the second page, does it not?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, actually, the third note here is probably the one to start with, and that's where we said we took a very, very long sentence and tried to break it into the component parts so that you would have maybe an easier time of seeing what is currently in the definition of the practice of soil classifying. And it also notes for instance, under paragraph 5, we reference maps and reports, and then we reference maps and reports of soil properties. So we're trying to sort through this entire definition. But we're also going to start with one question or comment. On line 11 of page 1, it says, this is the definition for the practice of soil classifying and the practice of professional soil classifying. Now, in my line of work, those are two definitions. And yet they're in the same section. So you can't have both. You can't have two titles and one definition, or one definition and two titles. And if they're separate things, we need to define them separately. If they're the same thing, we don't need to reference both. That, and then the other one we alluded to earlier, the whole discussion about the use of the word professional. And I know that's something that it's decades old, and it applies to many particular groups, but again, given my line of work, if I say something is professional, I say, what's the flip side? Non-professional? We don't want to talk about amateur soil classifying, though we might get into that. But if you're going to use a word like professional, it has to have a specific meaning.
Gentlemen, do you have a comment to that?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I don't have an issue with either just saying practice of soil classifying or the professional soil classifying. I agree. It doesn't have to be both.
Okay, with that, then we would just use practice of soil classifying and eliminate the rest?
One or the other.
Okay.
And again, Mr. Chairman, I think that that some of this wording, I think, probably can be worked out at a later date. I don't think it has to be specifically to now, but I guess that's up to the committee. And
we'd like to work our way through these as best we can. We will obviously take another look at this, but and as we go through it, probably another time, we'll just continue to refine it and shorten it so it's a little easier to read. Any other questions from the committee with respect to this section? If not, again, I will ask for the audience, if anybody wishes to make comment on this section, to come forward. If not, let us, Anita, move on to the next issue.
Mr. Chairman, the next issue we're dealing with is someone on page 2, roughly lines 13 to 17. This starts off saying an individual is construed to practice or offer to practice soil classifying if by verbal sign, claim, advertisement, etc., the individual represents that the individual is a soil classifier. And the phrase construed to practice is somewhat of an unfortunate choice. It, if you're saying that an individual is practicing or offering to practice soil classification, if the individual claims to be a soil classifier, what else is there? So I guess I'm nicely suggesting I don't see any reason to have the reference to an individual being construed to practice soil classifying. If you define a soil classifier, even if you have to define the art of soil classification, we probably don't need to have these lines in here at all.
You got a comment?
Comments, gentlemen?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I haven't looked at that closely, I guess, but I at this point, I don't think there'd be any reason to have that in there.
Mr. Chairman, I think the only reason it was in there is trying to, and it may be redundant, but trying to say that an individual can't put that they're a soil classifier in North Dakota on their card, business card, if they aren't, but that may be a redundant statement, but that's, think, what they're trying to get to.
Any questions from the committee? Okay, once again, I ask for the audience, anyone wish to comment on this section? Okay, if not, then we will, at this point in time, we will follow the suggestion of Ms. Thomas on that section. And let us move on to the next one then, Anita, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the next comment, I want to bring to your attention line 18. Now it says paragraph 1, which we've just discussed, is not applicable to an individual who is exempt under 433624. Now that particular section provides exemptions for reciprocity for a specific job, for employees or subordinates of soil classifiers, or one who engages in soil classifying for the individual's employer. And the issue that I was finding with this one is that I can employ a soil classifier, but I can't contract for services. And I was wondering what is the practical difference with respect to the job being performed. A regular employee versus one who's under contract, let's say, for a period of a year, or a period of 6 months, or a period of 3 months. Where is the line and where is the policy difference?
Yeah, Ms. Thomas, Chairman Schmidt, I honestly, I've looked at that and I don't think there should be a difference. If whether you're under contract or whether you're working individually for a subordinate, I think someone there should be registered. If they're working under a professional soil classifier to do the work, the one that's registered is still going to have to sign off on the work that's done.
Any questions or comments by the committee? Again, anybody from the audience wish to address this issue? Okay, if not, then we will go with the recommendation of Ms. Thomas again. And we'll move on to the next section, please.
OK,
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, top of page three, you're saying here that paragraph one is not applicable to an individual who conducts engineering surveys and soundings to determine soil properties influencing the design and construction of engineering and architectural projects. I'm assuming that this would have something to do with roads, buildings, tiling, but if you compare it to page two, lines one to two, we're talking about a soil classifier investigating and evaluating the effect of soil properties on various uses. Page two, line eight to nine, we're talking about soil classifiers determining the effect of soil properties on various uses. And I'm having trouble understanding this particular exception to what looks like the standard definition for soil classification.
Ms. Thomas, Chairman Schmidt, there is some gray areas in there in that, for example, on septic sightings, for example, in Cass County, you can either use a professional soil classifier to do the septic siting, or you can use a professional engineer, in which case they do perk tests, which are also, you know, they do, engineers typically do perk tests for septic systems. We use a classification system to do it. So there is some overlap there, but generally, we're interpreting different soil properties. And again, ours, we're focusing primarily on agricultural uses. There are, you know, looking for that suitable plant growth material, whether it's for growing agricultural crops and not for construction material.
Any comments from the committee? Any from the audience? Please state your name and your affiliation for the records, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grady Wolf. I'm with KLJ out of Bismarck. Quite a few things to address that were talked about earlier, some of the questions that arose and some of the work that we do. I'm not an engineer. For those of you that are familiar with KLJ, you're probably more familiar with our engineering services, planning services, or maybe our survey work that we do. But we do have about 40 staff who work in the environmental field and who do get involved with soils work in some way or another. We do not have a certified or a professional soil classifier on staff. We do not offer professional soil classifying services through KLJ, and we do not claim to. However, with some of the work that we do in the environmental field, we do look at soils, certain parameters of soils. Some of the things that we talked about earlier, there was a question by the chairman regarding wetlands and wetlands hydric soils. And I believe there was a question what it constitutes a hydric soil. A hydric soil is defined by the Army Corps of Engineers, who has the federal regulatory authority over wetlands. The NRCS also does get involved, or U.S. Department of Agricultural also does get involved with wetlands regarding farm programs, which many of the professional soil classifiers that are actually certified now is where they came into the ranks. They're all old NRCS type of personnel who dealt with farm program type services. Many of those people, the classifiers, you know, that's where they got to be. There's very few people who came in after them, or people outside of USDA or NRCS type of staff. So what we do, there was the question that defining a hydric soil, is that something that needs to be a professional soil classifier has to determine? Well, I know the same folks were in here earlier today when we talked about ginseng, when we talked about there's already a federal mandate or federal regulation that states regulations on ginseng. Well, the Army Corps of Engineers already has standards, federal standards, which clearly defines what a wetland is. And as part of those federal standards, it does not state that a professional soil classifier needs to be used, or that we technically need to define it as a certain soil series. It states if the soil has a certain parameter that meets the hydric definition of the soil, you can essentially check a box on a sheet and you can consider that soil to be hydric. Now, there was a mention as vegetation and hydrology as well, the three parameters of a wetland, and those parameters are also clearly defined. You know, hydric vegetation is clearly defined on what you can define as or what constitutes a vegetation. Hydrology is also clearly defined. So the only one that the question arises, and I think it arises right here, is does a professional soil classifier have to be used to then also look at the federal regulations and be able to check a box? Now, it's not clearly defined, in my opinion, and we've had others look at this. It's not clearly defined as if you technically need to be a professional professional soil classifier to technically do wetland work, because it never specifically calls that out in these regulations. It's a gray area. It does say that engineering surveys, which they mentioned before, they don't have to be professionals, and we have plenty of engineers in our group that look at soils for constructability on a daily basis. So we can build a $1 million skyscraper, but we can't define what a wetland is, because we might have to be a professional professional soil classifier. So from what we would like to see is to have an exclusion in these guidelines, not only state that engineering surveys, but also that wetland delineations, which are also clearly defined by federal regulations and defined, are also excluded in these guidelines. Thank you.
Questions from the committee for Mr. Wolf? Yeah, I have one, Mr. Wolf, if I may. When KLJ, let's say, gets a contract to assist a producer to delineate some wetlands, and obviously NRCS has done some work already on those delineations, but perhaps you are called out to do more defined, if you will, or whatever the case may be. When you do that, do you have a soil scientist go with you to check those soils and actually dig holes and do that type of activity, or do you have somebody other than a soil scientist do that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we talking specifically for a private client now, or the USDA?
The private client.
Private clients, we do not typically have a professional soil classifier dig the hole and check the box to say if it's hydric.
Do you have a soil scientist who may not be a professional do that?
No, we do not. We have a professional soil classifier on our staff on a temporary basis. So he is available, and we do use him when necessary. And certain clients of ours specify that a professional soil classifier is used. Reason being is because of the gray area within this bill.
Okay, then on the other side of that coin, you mentioned whether it be for an individual or for, I would assume, Fish and Wildlife Service would be the other that you would work for to do that, or another agency, shall I say. Okay, under that scenario, since it's not a private individual, how do you do that?
So the easiest question or the easiest answer would be right now the state of North Dakota. High Department of Transportation requires that a certified soil scientist be used, a professional soil classifier be used, because of the gray area within the bill. It's not directly stated. Is that an engineering principle then, or is it not an engineering principle? If you think about the DOT builds roads. So is that engineering? Is it covered under this paragraph? Is exempt? Is it not covered under that paragraph? So in those cases, we do use a professional soil classifier. When doing work for farmers and ranchers who, farmers mainly, who are dealing with the farm programs, a lot of times we will use a professional soil classifier because that's what they like to see. And in certain situations, I'll put it this way, the USDA likes to see a certified soil classifier. They've always had them. They've always worked with them. They believe that it's necessary for those programs. For our private clients, all the other clients and individuals that we work for, probably 99% of the time we do not use a professional soil classifier because it's as clearly defined by the federal regulations, it's not a necessity. The definitions of a hydric soil are clearly defined and we don't believe we use it or that it's required. Some more follow-up, I guess, that there was a statement that 50% of the states have professional soil classifiers. That might be the case, but of those 50% of the states, that does not regulate that they also require to be a professional soil classifier to do wetland soils. Our neighbor state, Minnesota, they have a professional soil classifier designation. However, they do not require you to be a professional soil classifier to classify hydric soils because those definitions that meet the criteria are clearly defined by the federal regulatory agency. And we all know Minnesota is a lot more strict than what we are from a regulatory standpoint. They do have a certification program in Minnesota for wetland specialists. Most of, if not all of our wetland people have went through that training, are certified in Minnesota. So we can look at soils and every other parameter and clearly define it in Minnesota under Minnesota's regulations. But when we get to North Dakota, there's a gray area because of soils discussion in this century code. That's a little bit gray.
Senator Lewick.
Mr. Chairman, and Grady, is
it? Yes, it is.
Mr. Wolf. You hit on a spot for me, personally. I have been working with the state of Minnesota since 1994, designing, installing, and inspecting septic systems in the state of Minnesota. And the soils classes that I had to take for the state of Minnesota every year through continuing education prepped me basically for this design work. Even though I'm a North Dakota resident, and primarily most of the work that I have been doing is on the Minnesota side, simply because North Dakota regulations weren't as strict in those days as we're trying to get them a little bit better on course right now. But so working on the Minnesota side just suited me fine. But for me to come into North Dakota to do this design work, I would under this, would it, in your opinion, would you think that a person would have to be a soil classifier per se in the state of North Dakota to do that very same work as far as designing for septic systems?
Senator, in my opinion, I believe there's tests that can be done that could essentially an engineer or professional engineer or other individual could complete that type of test, looking at saturation and uptake of water and holding capacities, that could then make those determinations that a professional soil classifier would not be required to go out and take a look at those.
Let me continue, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wolf. The reason I bring that up is because I'm wondering if the need is there for some of these instances where is there a direct correlation between the importance of having that smaller piece of property identified and with the need of a soil scientist, or if there is the need for someone of less training or a degree, for example, to do that very same work. We were told in our training that doing actually the PERC tests are actually archaic because of all of the organic matter that could possibly be in the soil. So doing the classification is actually a better route to take through defining soil probabilities or what actually the could actually that soil could be classified for. And so I have a little bit of a conflict, I guess, as far as if everybody needs to have the degrees that each and every one is called out to have. And so that's why I was questioning whether you what you thought about that, because I know that you have some contention about whether your people in your firm are actually capable of doing this very same job. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Wolf, would you like to add anything else?
Yes, please. Mr. Chairman, follow-up to that. Regarding septic systems, I'm not an engineer, and I won't comment on that further because I think that's probably better spoken to by somebody else who is an engineer and has done those tests. With that being said, there was mention earlier that that regarding hydric soils, that that because people from the outside maybe don't know what North Dakota soils are, that that they're hoping, essentially there's a hope that we're looking at the soils correctly and that we're actually calling them out correctly. I've been doing wetland work for quite a while. I worked in an NRCS office before I worked with KLJ. So I worked with farmers and ranchers, I worked with soils, worked through the farm programs, been there, done that. With that being said, I've also been out in the field and we've used professional soil classifiers on wetland work. And Mr. Bowman, Senator Bowman, mentioned earlier that defining a soil can be a really fine line on what's what. Well, with that being said, I know the federal regulations pretty well from an Army Corps of Engineers standpoint, and probably better than what some of the soil classifiers, professional soil, in my opinion, what some of the professional soil classifiers know the federal regulations regarding soils. It's also my job, before that report gets sent into the Army Corps of Engineers, to review that document. So what I put my name on and sent to the Army Corps of Engineers has to be correct regarding the federal guidelines. Well, what some of the information that I've gotten from a professional soil classifier actually did not meet the federal criteria. So in those instances, there's a very fine line on what meets the definition and what does not meet the definition, and if it's applied correctly. So just because you're certified or a professional doesn't mean that it's always correct. But there is clearly defined federal regulatory guidelines that state it's this or this. And if I can say that this soil has those that type of structure or that type of, you know, maybe a color, and I can check a box that meets a federal regulatory definition, and we should be able to call it hydric soil. Thank you.
In that case, Mr. Wolf, could you not then get a high school kid that would be able to do that?
Chairman, depending on what the parameter is that you're trying to define, I would say that with taking a high school kid into the field for one day and showing them 75%, not all, but probably 75% of the indicators which describe what a hydric soil is, they would be able to define them on their own looking at that soil.
Thank you. Any other further comments or questions from Mr. Wolf? If not, thank you, sir. Oh, and that, and Daryl, do you have a comment? And by the way, if Mr. Wolf, if you would like to reply to Daryl's comment, you're certainly welcome to come up and do that.
You've pretty much taken a, Mr. Wolf, you've pretty much taken us apart here. But I want to go into one of your comments. I know that your engineering firm also goes out and identifies topsoil depth. Is that not a something that falls underneath the law? If you don't think the wetlands do, do you not think that that is part of our law? That's my question.
Mr. Wolf, respond, please.
Could you be more specific on when we would define what topsoil is?
For the depth of lifting a topsoil, when you're doing drilling pads, etc.
To my knowledge, nobody in our environmental group has done that. If one of our engineers is doing that, I believe that probably would be exempt under the engineering surveys to determine soil properties under construction. As for our environmental staff, we do not clearly define what the topsoil is. We have looked at what a black layer is, yes, but we also clearly go back to NRCS guidelines, which most of these guys have been the ones that said this is what kind of soil it is, and we reference that. From a well pad standpoint, I've looked at hundreds of well pads, literally, and there's so much variation between soils from a corner to another corner, or topsoil depth, or different horizons, that when the guy goes out there with a big piece of machinery, and whether he's taking 6 inches or 8 inches, he goes out and hogs dirt, and it really doesn't matter what you say anyway, to be honest with you. That's kind of what ends up happening.
Okay, thank you. Any comments from the committee? If not, let's take a 15-minute break. We'll be back at 2:15. Thank you. Get the meeting back to order, please. My apologies for going an extra 5 minutes. Okay, with that, Representative Rust.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to kind of get back to the basics. I'm trying to understand some things here, and I wonder if the committee is having some of the same questions I do. And before we get maybe too deep into this bill, my question would be probably, do we need to have people come before this committee who would be able to tell us who needs soil classifiers? And then once that happens, what qualifications do those people need? Otherwise, I'm a little concerned that I don't know if I've got the proper frame of reference of where to go with this particular bill.
Okay, any other comments? Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Rust's analogy. I'd like to hear from the stakeholders or the recipients of these services to get a better idea of the importance of the title that we're putting on.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Well, I, as chair, I will agree with you, gentlemen, on that. And so what I will do then is I will direct Anita to work with these gentlemen and Mr. Wolf and DOT and others so that at the next meeting that we have, we get a very good idea of the committee members as to exactly what professional soil classifiers do, who uses them, why is that level of expertise necessary here versus a one-day training of a high school kid to do this over here? So we have got a better idea of the impacts of this bill before we go any further. Okay? So with that, I'm going to stop the discussion on this bill till then, and we will move on to our next agenda item, which is basically the committee discussion, and if there's any further discussion other than what we've already had, I'd certainly entertain that. If not, Senator Bowman.
I'd like to find out what federal impacts that laws have that deal with this. And but when you're like building roads and you have wetlands and all these things on construction, counties have this problem a lot. Find out the impact, and if you change certain things, how is that going to impact the cost of projects and things like that. I think that's all a part of this big picture, and we want to be really sure before we put a final bill draft together that we're putting it together with the right background knowledge to make a good decision.
Thank you, sir, and I believe we have DOT guys with us, do we not? Do we have any, I was told that we were going to have somebody from the health department here. Does anybody from the health department here? No? Okay. But yeah, we've got DOT here, and Mr. DeWald can certainly work with Anita and come up with some of that, I'm certain. Can you not, David? Yeah, he will. I know he will. Okay, with that, there isn't any other discussion? Yeah, let's, I'm going to ask Anita, when should we have our next scheduled meeting?
Mr. Chairman, you and I can look at the calendar. What we normally ask the committee members to do is to let me know in the next 30 to 60 days if you have any major commitments and times when you could not be available for a meeting. You all have my email address, and just drop me a note if you get to enjoy a vacation in the warmer climates or something like that. And then you and I can check out the calendar and see what we've got available.
Senator Bowman.
I have one conflict on the first and third Tuesdays of the month.
Okay.
That's the only conflict that I have.
Still a county commissioner, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other comments by the committee? If not, I sincerely appreciate your attendance and your participation, because without your participation, we don't go anywhere. So, thank you very kindly, and we'll be in touch, obviously. Meeting adjourned.